And that's my real concern, is if we don't get in gear right now and get to work and mobilize voters, we may be looking at an outcome that we don't like. I just can't wake up on November 4th thinking that there was something I didn't do.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was very glad to have the chance to talk with Alex Morgan. Alex is the co-founder and executive director of the Progressive Turnout Project, a grassroots-funded organization with the mission of getting Democrats to the polls. They design, test, and execute specialized voter turnout programs targeting inconsistent Democratic voters in the most competitive districts in the country. Though their work has been complicated by COVID this year, they are moving forward. Alex tells a rather amazing story about the founding and growth of the Progressive Turnout Project. Their first year, he and his co-founder set out to raise $50,000 in small donations, but raised $5 million instead. Now, a couple years later, they're over $50 million, all to be used for building field programs with paid staff. You should know about the Progressive Turnout Project and what they're doing. So, first our sponsor, and then my interview with Alex Morgan and the Progressive Turnout Project.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Alex, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Alex Morgan. I'm the executive director at Progressive Turnout Project. And this all really came together in 2015 because of, you know, my experience always being a super volunteer. When I was a student growing up in Michigan, I was always in the Jennifer Granholm campaign office, our first female governor in Michigan, and then the John Kerry campaign office and all the heartbreak that came with being a volunteer in 2004, you know, where I really got my start and really rolled up my sleeves for the first time was as the head of the state of Michigan coordinator for the Students for Obama program in 2008. So I feel like I'm a part of that class of organizers who, you know, came up through the first Obama campaign and really never looked back from there in terms of my political and organizing career. I did spend time professionally as a teacher. I taught kindergarten for 3 years in Milwaukee, in Wisconsin, another important swing state. And I always tell folks that my experience there, you know, having patience for little ones makes it a little harder sometimes to work with adults who maybe don't require or shouldn't require as much patience. But it gave me just renewed perspective, you know, teaching in the time that Scott Walker was in his first term in Wisconsin, just how important the work is that we do, which is why I ended up, you know, going into politics full time and ended up ultimately, you know, helping start this organization and doing this work.
Tell me about the startup story there, the founding story. How did that all get going?
So myself and the person I started this with, Harry Pascal, both worked for Congressman Brad Schneider in the 2014 cycle, which we all know with everything going on in the world now, doesn't seem like it was such a terrible time, but, you know, we had some of our worst electoral losses that year in our party's history. So Harry and I walked away from 2014, having worked in a race where we lost by about 5,000 votes. And we said, what is it going to take, especially without Barack Obama at the top of the ticket, to ensure that inconsistent Democratic voters, you know, folks who 9 times out of 10 are going to support our candidates if they go out and vote, what's it going to take to get them to the polls in a really important election year? And so we put together a proposal. We were looking for folks to get our efforts off the ground here in Illinois. We were looking for $50,000 to run an early investment field program, something that would get us started in the spring, a way to engage volunteers and get a field program up and running early when we could start talking with folks from a best practice perspective about the issues that they care about and connecting that to why voting in an upcoming election is so important. And we wanted to do that because I'm sure, you know, many of your listeners have had that experience of knocking on doors in September or October and getting the response from folks that you only come around when there's an election. Does your party actually care about what happens in my community? And so this was about finding a way to have conversations earlier and have repeated conversations with voters so that we could mitigate all of that on the back end of an election and talk about, you know, just how important it is to engage and circle back to those early conversations. We ended up fundraising online, which really ballooned, you know, in the era of Trump. And we were able to not just raise $50,000 in the 2016 cycle, but $5 million. And I think that was for a variety of reasons of us being at the right place at the right time, but also this feeling that traditional campaigns maybe weren't focusing on the right things, right? Folks don't want their grassroots contributions going up on, you know, TV ads, right? Regardless how you feel about them, they want to know that their contribution is going to get out the vote, the thing that they think makes a difference, the thing that they are most tangibly able to connect with from perhaps their own volunteer experiences. And I think a lot of the frustrations around, you know, what was happening with the DNC that cycle and with Bernie Sanders running for president that cycle, there just was a really strong sentiment toward contributing small dollars toward grassroots efforts like ours. And so we really benefited from the timing there. And obviously, Donald Trump has just been, you know, gasoline on the fire over the past 4 years that we, you know, went from raising $5 million in 2016 to raising about $25 million in 2018. And we're on pace to invest at least $52.5 million in programs this cycle. So it has just been this rapid growth over the past 5 years to get us where we are today.
That's actually incredible and fairly rare among progressive groups that, you know, started out small, aiming at 50,000, more than fairly rare. Aside from the good timing, how did you go about raising money? Where's that money coming from?
We are getting it almost exclusively from our fundraising emails. Folks have pointed out that we have a pretty aggressive email program that can rub some folks the wrong way. And I did an interview with the Washington Post at the beginning of this cycle about how, you know, there just is so much urgency right now. I mean, our country is on fire right now. I mean, the president of the United States has been impeached. He continues to incite violence and, you know, has no regard for the rule of law. And so I think the aggressive email program that we have combined with the grassroots energy that is out there and the frustration that is out there and the eagerness to just do whatever we can to get Donald Trump and his enablers out of Washington has really contributed to the success of our program. And I just think about folks who are sitting at home, right? I mean, this is our base, our folks who maybe are no longer able to, you know, get out and knock on doors themselves, or maybe are young professionals who don't, you know, think they have enough time to maybe get on the phone and make phone calls, or they're too busy raising their family or balancing multiple personal priorities. But they do think, and know that a $5 contribution, a $15 contribution, a $50 contribution on a regular basis can make some impact. And they're right.
Do you use a email fundraising firm or do that in-house?
We have, for the course of our 5 years, worked with folks at Mothership Strategies, who also have some history in Illinois' 10th district. It's how we've met folks over the years and maintain those relationships.
And they do have that reputation for the aggressive email fundraising, I've heard.
They do, yes. And I you know, the three partners, you know, came out of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which, you know, also has that aggressive style. And, you know, I don't know where we go after the 2020 election when, you know, I pray that we come out of this victorious, because we have to come out of this victorious. But, you know, how I have always felt about our approach is, you know, we are in unprecedented times. That has always been the underlying piece there for me about why and how we're putting these dollars to work. I don't know what that looks like, you know, under a Democratic administration, but we'll certainly cross that bridge, you know, when we get there, hopefully in less than a year's time.
To what extent are you funded by larger donations?
Our average contribution is $15. So that has been the really great piece about building this organization ourselves and running it on small dollar contributions, is we have not been at the whims of any particular individual's interests, which can sometimes be the case. You have to play up to your donors' interests in terms of the work you're doing. We've never had to do that, which is really great. We can focus on best practice field programs that we know work. And the other piece, you know, especially right now, although I think the market has started to rebound a little bit, but who knows? And I think the other thing that a lot of organizations struggle with in a time like this is economic uncertainty. And if you've got big donors who become concerned about their portfolios, that may be a hit to the program that you're able to run. So we have just been so grateful for the grassroots support that we've received over the past 5 years, because it allows us to put our dollars toward programs that we know work and aren't just built around somebody's, you know, personal interest.
That's pretty enviable. As you've grown from that 5 to 25 to 52 million dollars, has the staff grown? How has that tracked over time?
You know, in 2016, I was able to drive to every program that we ran. I hopped in my Ford Focus, and I was able to, you know, run up from Chicago to our program in Illinois 10 and go up, you know, even further to a program we had in Wisconsin and over to Iowa and Minnesota. We went with flippable house districts that year that were in close distance to our headquarters. And then in 2018, I found myself on the road all the time as we were running 18 programs across 17 different states. And how we structure our programs is we work to open offices that have somewhere between 10 and 20 field representatives, full-time staff who are knocking on doors pretty much all day, every day. And we have full-time staff because we never wanted to take away volunteers from the campaigns that we're hoping to help, right? Volunteers are the lifeblood of particular candidate campaigns. And we wanted to make sure that we were providing opportunities for folks to do this work if they were really passionate about it, and that we were able to get some tremendous numbers out of the folks who come on board at the same time. So we went from, you know, having 6 offices, and 60 staff, to having 18 offices and more than 200 staff. And now in 2020, with the ability to invest a little over $50 million, we're looking at having over 70 offices in 17 battleground states with over 1,000 staff, who we hope are going to be able to knock on, you know, 10.5 million doors this year.
The coronavirus, COVID-19 disease, has got to be throwing a bit of a wrench into these works. What's the plan?
So we have spent the past 2 months here, you know, in the midst of this global pandemic, thinking about how do we adjust our programs as a result. And we were very fortunate that we had already hired and trained the folks who we brought on board to open all of our offices. So it didn't put that work in limbo. We already have really great staff, 118 staff on the ground in our battleground states. But, you know, as we got around to hiring of field representatives who are those folks who will go out and knock on doors was right when the pandemic took off in this country. And we had to put those efforts, not the interviewing, but the actual hiring and training of folks on hold. We had planned to launch our program at the beginning of May. And instead, what we did was we shifted folks to a phone program that we're running and that I hope to talk about in a little bit here. But we've also spent that time digging in and doing as much research as we can about how to make sure we can canvass in a safe way. I actually was on the phone with an infectious disease doctor yesterday morning. It is not an expert that I ever thought I would need on a campaign. But it has been very helpful in thinking about, okay, what do these experiences look like at the door? Obviously, we are outside, which is a big benefit, but what can we do? That includes making sure that we're investing in masks for every employee, making sure that we're ensuring there's social distancing in every conversation. So this is not standing on someone's front porch anymore. It's knocking on the door and making sure that you step back at least 6 feet and probably more. And we took a cue from the census, who has still been doing some literature drops right now, and we're putting all the materials that we would ordinarily exchange with a voter into what we're calling a voter kit, a bundle of information that is sealed and put together ahead of time in our office. We'll be leaving those at the doorstep so that we can still leave behind information with voters. And we're making sure to put a little hand sanitizer packet and a one-time use a pen in there for the voter as well. So I think it's going to be awkward a little bit when we finally get this thing off the ground and we have those initial conversations. And we don't know ultimately how voters are going to respond. And so we are going to be looking very closely at, you know, the number of folks who opt out and say, you know, I'm really uncomfortable with you knocking on my door, to determine if this is something that we can continue. But it's my hope that by taking these steps and showing voters that safety is at the forefront of the work that we're doing, but that we're also doing this really critical work at this important time in our country's history to change the course of what's happening in Washington, I think voters will appreciate the work that we're doing and find a renewed sense of urgency around this election.
You said you started this with Harry Pascal. Is that the name?
Yeah, Harry Pascal has become my best friend over the past 5 years here. We spend all of our time together.
Tell me about him. What is he bringing?
Harry is a semi-retired CPA accountant. You know, he had his own accounting practice for a long time, and then he retired, I believe, ahead of the 2006 election cycle. He lives just north of Chicago, like I do now, and you know, he wanted to get involved. Like many volunteers who, all of us who have worked in politics have met over the years, you've got a good chunk of folks who are really young and want to get involved, and a lot of folks who have recently retired and say, now I have the time to make a difference. And that was Harry. He went into the Dan Seals campaign office, and they put him to work with lawn signs at first, which we always joke about because obviously we care about having in-person conversations and a little less about things like lawn signs. But when they learned he was an accountant, this is when things changed. They said, we need a treasurer. Can you do that? And that's how he got sucked into his second win here as a campaign treasurer and financial strategist, really. His business background has been incredibly helpful in terms of setting up our organization and thinking about all the needs that we have as an entity that has over 1,000 employees, right, and is managing a budget of over $50 million. So he's always been a behind the scenes kind of guy. And what I loved about him was when we both worked for Brad Schneider in 2014, Harry always came up to my field office and he would knock on doors on the weekend. And before he left, he would always ask me if I needed anything. And I never did take him up on the offer that cycle, but he always reminded me that he was the person who cut the checks on the campaign. So if I really needed something that I thought was going to be beneficial, that I should skip all my supervisors and just go right to him, which just says a lot about his interest in making sure that we have the resources to get the job done. So he's a guy who's incredibly creative and just passionate about making sure we are good stewards of these grassroots contributions that we receive and that we put them to work in the most effective way possible.
I think of people like you two as kind of political entrepreneurs. What do you think you've learned about entrepreneurship in the space that you're in?
I have learned an awful lot, especially from Harry. There's often a dynamic between field teams and finance teams, right? Because oftentimes the finance team is telling you why you can't spend money on something in particular that you think will be really impactful in the field. I just gained a real appreciation of the whole of a political operation by partnering with him. And something that has always been really important to us from day one, knowing that we have so many grassroots contributors, is customer service. So anytime someone replies to one of our emails, we have someone who's checking that account. And sure, you know, people will pop off with a whole variety of opinions, but when you sift through them, you find folks who do have really legitimate and concrete ideas and concerns or just interest in being more involved or just knowing more about what you do because they're interested in contributing more, but need to know more first. And so that customer service aspect is something that comes with being an entrepreneur, a successful entrepreneur, I think. And it's extended from beyond just our donors, but also in terms of our employees. To recruit, hire, and train 1,100 people is no small endeavor. And it requires someone who's, you know, got a vision that folks can buy into and also know that they're being heard. And I think that COVID has been actually a really tremendous example of putting that service aspect to work among our employees. We have hundreds of folks who have signed up to do this work and didn't know at the time that we would be doing it amid a pandemic. And so rightfully, a lot of folks have been on edge as we've been preparing to get started. And we've had a number of all-staff town halls where we just listen to every question that folks on our team have so that we can go back and get to work adjusting our plans accordingly to make sure we're, you know, doing everything that we can to show our staff that we're taking their concerns seriously. I spent my Memorial Day weekend, you know, revising our scenario and response planning around coronavirus. And then I followed up with every member on our team, because that's what a good entrepreneur does, is they circle back and close the loop and assure folks that they've been heard and that their ideas were at the very least considered, if not, you know, implemented as a part of the plan. So it's something that we've taken seriously with our donors, our general supporters, and our employees.
What have you built out as far as a team sort of between you and Harry and the 1,000 canvassers? Is there other team members?
There are, yes. Yeah. When we started this, we knew that Harry had the mind for finance. I had the mind for the program. as we've gotten bigger, we've recognized that communications is an area that neither of us had a skill set. We have a really great communications director, Kate Sweeney, on our team, who had previously worked for Bernie and the Progressive Change Campaign Committee previously. We have a really tremendous data and analytics director, Anastasia, who, you know, is thinking about the universes that we're working with this cycle. And she's got a team of deputy data directors who are really digging in and thinking about how we can present all of our information to be actionable for our field team. And then we've got a whole bunch of other folks, you know, in our bloodstream here at PTP, you know, from our operations department to our office manager to, you know, a handful of interns and our training director, who all have the ability to specialize in the areas that they're working in and really make this whole thing go forward.
How have you managed coordination with other progressive groups that also do canvassing or maybe do phones in the cases where you're doing that to not overwhelm the targeted voters?
We sit at the America Votes table, which is the big convening of independent expenditure political groups. And anywhere that they convene a state table, we loop in our field staff as well. So it is not as though voters are not going to hear from multiple groups, but we make sure that we are coordinating with those other groups to ensure that we're in different neighborhoods on different days so that we don't have the scenario where someone knocked on someone's door, you know, 15 minutes prior to the person on our team. We aren't able to coordinate with campaigns where we do these large field programs. So there is still the possibility of some overlap, but we have always tried to be a team player in the progressive and democratic space, including when it comes to the data that we collect, which I know isn't what you asked about, but it's something I think about an awful lot. And something that I've been really pleased to see the party move forward on in terms of building out the Democratic Data Exchange, because I think, you know, an organization like Progressive Turnout Project has a lot to offer when it comes to the conversations that we have with voters and the information we collect. And whenever possible, we want to get that information to our progressive partners so that they are able to act on it too, so that when they go to send that big flight of mail in October or deploy their phone programs or run their digital, if they're able to segment based on, you know, knowing someone cares, you know, their top priority is the environment or choice or education or criminal justice reform, we hope that we're able to contribute to that.
What political technologies do you use for canvassing and phone contact and so on?
The voter file is the big one. So VAN is our go-to in terms of how our field team operates. In the era of coronavirus, all of our trainings are now being done via Zoom. So that has become a new and important piece of technology that I wouldn't have imagined integrating into our programs as much as we are. And then our data team spends much of their time once the program launches in Civis, in Tableau, building out pipelines and reports so that we can all see the important work that's being done and share that with our partners. So those are probably the real bones of our operation.
How do you understand the impact that you've had, you know, in 2016 and 2018, and what are you looking to have in 2020?
Something that we really prided ourselves on in 2016 and 2018 was running randomized control trials of our program. You know, I told you that Harry and I kind of started Progressive Turnout Project on a whim. And once we got to be a certain size, and once we knew we would be running more than one program, we said we really are going to have to be able to point back and prove that the work we did actually made a difference, because otherwise people are going to continue questioning the value of this. So in 2018, we set up every field program we ran as a randomized control trial. That was 18 programs. And on average, the folks we had in our universe, so it didn't matter if we had a conversation with them or not, you know, a true treatment group, we saw that on average, we increased turnout 10.4% among our target voters. There were a couple places where we saw we didn't really have an impact. It was Colorado and Washington State, two all vote by mail states. So we've been thinking a lot about how to incorporate more messaging about mail voting into our program. And I think that's only become more important this year. You know, our takeaway from 2018 was that even with a ton of voter energy and participation, right, the highest turnout in a midterm election in our lifetimes, we could still make a difference on top of that. For 2020, we are going all in to leave it all on the field in terms of our efforts. You know, we're going to leave no stone unturned and make sure that we're knocking on every door that we can have and have every conversation that we can have to make a difference in this critical election year.
Will you be adjusting sort of the program as you get closer to the election and you see what states are close, what states aren't, what races are close, what aren't? Or is it sort of calculated in advance and sort of rolls forward?
So we're operating from the assumption that the biggest presidential battlegrounds are going to be Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and the biggest Senate battlegrounds are going to be Arizona, Colorado, Maine, and North Carolina. So you'll see our largest investments are in those states because we expect them to be on the board all the way through this cycle. The other nine states that we're having a field presence in, states like Alabama, Montana, Iowa, we have a good number of offices set up in those states so that we can expand and, you know, put additional personnel and resources into those states if they get closer. We also haven't quite gone all in those places because they're kind of more on the margins at this time. So building out that infrastructure is really difficult for a field program. We wanted to make sure we had managers and offices and a baseline number of field staff in place in every potentially competitive state. And then we've really, you know, doubled and tripled down in those places that we know are going to be battlegrounds all the way through.
This has got to feel pretty amazing to have pulled off this large of an operation without, as it seems, at least how you've recounted it, without basing it on big connections at the highest levels of the party or big donors or that kind of connection world that a lot of people operate in. Am I right about that?
You are right. I feel like we are a unicorn in many ways, and it is a real blessing, a real honor to be able to do this work without any even hint of a string attached to it. That's why we wake up every day thinking about how many days are left, what we can get done, and what it's going to take to defeat Donald Trump, because that's who folks are fearful of and motivated by to win this thing. I feel that urgency from our supporters because it's folks of all backgrounds, right? I think about my dad who works at a deli, wage job, gave his $27 to Bernie Sanders, right? And so we've got plenty of donors who are like that and who will really benefit from having folks who are fighting for them in Washington. And I think about them. And then we have folks who just have been the folks in these resistance organizations and have some extra time and have some extra dollars and just know that what's going on right now is fundamentally not right. And I think of everyone in between who just makes up our supporter base. And I think about how, you know, by sending us their $15, they are counting on us to get this job done. That weighs on me every day. And We just really have to win on November 3rd.
You're talking about what your donors want, but you and Harry must have a personal feeling about this president and the party that he's with yourself. What is your own attitude towards what we've got there in the White House?
I mentioned this in my bio, at the top of our conversation. When I graduated from school, I didn't want anything to do with politics because it seemed like, okay, the first 2 years of the Obama administration, we got some good stuff done. There was healthcare, which, looking back is such a monumental achievement. There was some Wall Street reform, there was some student loan reform, but it just felt like, what did we do here, right? That's how I left, 2010 after our big wave of defeats. I was the college Democrat president in Michigan that year. And it just was crushing to lose up and down the ticket. And, I said, all right, I'm going to make a difference in a community, right? I'm going to teach, a class of kids. And I loved teaching kindergarten because those kids could get excited about anything. So it just was uplifting every day. But teaching in Wisconsin in 2010, that same election, had this impact. And slowly seeing the impact of the decisions made by a governor like Scott Walker is what pulled me back into the fight. And so while Donald Trump has fanned the flames and, like I said, poured gasoline on it all, this is the Republican Party. They will say one thing on the campaign trail and then go to Washington and do the opposite. Donald Trump is different in that he tells it like he sees it. But they're really, at the end of the day, in their actions, not that different than he is. And I think we see that on display right now with their response to the coronavirus, with their response to the murder of George Floyd. The Republican Party lacks any semblance of morals. That's what has got me in this fight, was looking at my kids every day over the course of my 3 years teaching and saying to myself, okay, I'm having a positive impact on this group of kids behind this door. And I hope that they will become civically engaged, in the 20 years from now when they're out on their own. But then I just looked at what was happening to them, to their families, to our community, and said, I can't sit on the sidelines. I can't be in a job where I'm not advocating for change, because I felt like the world was on fire then. It's crazy to believe how far we've come from that point with everything that is going on now. So this is just a culminating election year for us. And, my words of warning to folks are, I want this to be more like 2008 and less like 2004. And that's my real concern, is if we don't get in gear right now and get to work and mobilize voters, we may be looking at an outcome that we don't like. I just can't wake up on November 4th thinking that there was something I didn't do.
The model that you have, if I understand it, with paid canvassers and small donors is a little different than others. Like, you'll have places like Swing Left where they kind of use volunteer canvassers. Do you employ any hybrid like that, or is it all the model that you've described?
The bulk of our work is this large canvas operation with full-time field staff. I love Swing Left. I've got great friends over there, and I love what they are doing, bringing groups of volunteers together. Same with Indivisible. I live in Evanston, just north of Chicago, and I love my local Indivisible group. They are amazing. The one thing that we do that is somewhat close to that is on the coordinated side for our, right now we've got 101 endorsed candidates, and I know we'll roll out more in the coming weeks as more primaries wrap up. We offer them field fellows. So we know that every campaign has, an intern that they had over the summer or a super volunteer who maybe would give more hours if they could get paid but they just aren't able to commit any more than the shift that they do on the weekend or what they do from home. Around September, our fellows program coordinator does a series of trainings with folks who've been identified by our endorsed candidates to get them prepared to come on to those campaigns full time to do some kind of combination of direct voter contact that's going to be beneficial to the campaigns. So that's an opportunity that can be full time. It can be part time. There's candidates who've split the contribution because we have to go just up to the federal limit of $5,000 that we can contribute. Some campaigns have split that, you know, five ways with interns who have been on the campaign so they can do more hours. Others have used it to fund a GOTV director. We've seen folks get really creative there. And that is one way that I think we've engaged folks other than, you know, just through full-time work.
I'm certain you're aware that there's some debate within the progressive movement about the targeting of field, whether you're going after kind of base voters or kind of swing voters, whether you're doing persuasion or more just get out the vote. How do you target? What are you aiming your canvassing at specifically?
Our philosophy and our efforts have always been focused on, you know, who we call turnout voters. So folks who, again, you know, 9 times out of 10 when we have these conversations are likely to vote for the Democrat on their ticket. The question is, will they go and vote? There is certainly value in persuasion work, but we know that at least coming into our creating a progressive turnout project, there was an awful lot of time, attention, and resources spent on, you know, developing the right TV ads and probably now digital ads to persuade folks to vote for our candidate, and persuasion phone banks and mailers. What we saw as a real gap was an effort at talking with folks who are going to come out and support us almost every time. And it's something that we often found was neglected until the final weeks. So that's why, you know, all of our efforts have been focused on getting commitments to vote from inconsistent, what we call inconsistent Democratic voters, right? So turnout voters.
Are you canvassing right now or waiting to launch it?
We haven't launched our programs just yet. We think we'll be launching in the next couple of weeks. It has been really challenging with, you know, there's no federal standard around next steps when it comes to the coronavirus. So we have been looking at what each and every one of our target states is doing and how they're reopening businesses and thinking about, you know, what sort of benchmarks align with safely launching a program. But we think by the end of June, we will have folks in some places out in the field. And hopefully by the end of July, we're full force.
Is there a question I haven't asked that I should have?
The only one that maybe I didn't answer the best, it's not that you didn't ask it, is about our volunteers. I went and I talked about our fellows program just a little while ago. But in response to coronavirus, we've been pointing a lot of folks to a phone program that we've put together. We know that folks are at home itching to take action. And so we launched a program called Turnout 2020. Where anyone across the country, it doesn't matter if you live in a blue state or a purple state, can hop on the phone and call target voters in competitive places across the country. And right now, what we're really focused on and have been focused on since the Wisconsin primary and Supreme Court election, when we saw so many folks standing in line for hours at just a handful of polling places in Milwaukee, is calling and talking with folks about signing up to vote by mail, you know, right now for the November election. So any state that allows us to do that, and, you know, Pennsylvania is one, Arizona is one, Wisconsin is one, we are encouraging volunteers to join that effort at turnout2020.org and participate in our call events and our Turnout Tuesdays to talk with voters in these battleground states and talk with them about potentially voting by mail this year. So we're really excited about that effort. It allows us to do something right now and have conversations right now while we retool our field program. And I think it's something that's going to be a great opportunity for folks as we continue through the cycle. And that may be the way that certain folks want to participate this year is through that phone program.
I'm curious what you think of prospective nominee Biden and whether you have an opinion about who he should pick as VP.
I think he has a lot of great choices. I will be totally transparent with you that I was a Warren supporter in the primary. Obviously, I think she would be a great choice, but I also recognize the need to have a person of color on the ticket. I just look at his personal rapport with Senator, you know, Kamala Harris. And I think he's someone who thrives off of that kind of personal relationship. So as much as I would love to see a Vice President Warren personally, I also wonder who's going to be the best pick for him. I see those qualities in Kamala, but I think he's got great, great options. Stacey Abrams, comes to top of mind with all the great work that she has done in Georgia. My own former college Democrat supporter in Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, has been a wonderful champion for folks her entire career. And I think would be a great choice. But, you know, those are the sort of folks who come to the top of mind for me. But I think he's going to make the right choice for him. And I'm just excited to get to work for whoever it is. And I know there's all this talk about, you know, whether or not Joe Biden is progressive enough is something that, you know, we've heard swirl through stories throughout the primary. And I just like to point back to the fact that, you know, we do a lot of polls to our email supporters. And right after Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, you know, Joe Biden was often right there at the top of the pack. You know, and I think about the fact that he's been a champion for so many of our issues for so long. So I'm just excited to get out the vote for Vice President Biden and for whoever he picks and for Democrats up and down the ticket so that we can take back the Senate, which has been a tremendous roadblock for us for at least the past decade, and keep our majority in the House.
It has been, Alex, a real honor to talk to you and really amazing what you have put together over the last very few number of years. And I am certainly rooting for you to make the difference in a bunch of these races, because like you, I can't face a bad election day in this current context.
We are going to do everything that we can. And thank you for all of your work highlighting the folks who are in this fight with us. So really appreciate everything that you're doing, and let's go win.
That was Alex Morgan at the Progressive Turnout Project. Alex is at turnoutpack.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.